Welcome to The Word at First Pres. During Advent, we are doing a series called Christmas Tableaus. A tableau is an illustration, often with religious overtones. The idea of each sermon will be to take an object from the story of Jesus' birth and discuss how it informs our faith. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful Advent and a very Merry Christmas.
This reading comes from Matthew chapter 2. In the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem, asking, "Where is the child who has been born king of the Jews? For we observed his star in the east and have come to pay him homage." When King Herod heard this, he was frightened, and all Jerusalem with him. Then Herod secretly called for the Magi and learned from them the exact time when the star had appeared. Then he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word so that I may also go and pay him homage." When they had heard the king, they set out, and there, ahead of them, went the star that they had seen in the east, until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw that the star had stopped, they were overwhelmed with joy. On entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they knelt down and paid him homage. Then, opening their treasure chests, they offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Now God has spoken to us.
So this is my 10th year doing this Christmas Eve service. Can you believe that? 10 years ago? 10 years ago, these guys were a lot smaller too. When I got here, my son Elijah was 3 years old, and my son Lucas was 8 months old. And now those two little guys are 12 and 9. And as I kind of alluded to last Christmas, some of the magic of Christmas has kind of gotten away from them due to their age. It's not that they don't like Christmas. It's just that, you know, they enjoy getting together with friends. They enjoy getting together with family. But making a list for Santa, not their top priority any longer. And that's natural. I think we all can say in here that as we get older, as we age, we kind of get distant from those childlike impulses that we had that made Christmas so spectacular when we were young. And I think part of that is perhaps, and I don't know if you'd agree with me, but I think it's the case that as you get older, when you look back on Christmas when you were a child, you think to yourself, well, it's because I was a kid looking at the world through the lens of a child that's why Christmas was so incredible. That's really what made it magical, is that I was a child and I didn't know that much about the world. And as I was preparing for this sermon, I had a memory come back to me, a memory that I hadn't thought about for a long time. It was when I was 14 years old, and it called into question whether or not all of the magic of Christmas was actually in my mind or not. So to lay the foundation for this story, I have to go back to when I was 10 years old. So when I was 10, I started mowing lawns. That was like my first year of mowing lawns. And my dad, he said, "You're going to mow our lawn every week." And if you're 10, is anybody in here, did your parents ever make you do this, or you had normal parents? Okay, so if you had parents that made you do this, I had to do that. So I'm 10 years old, I can barely, you know, like how you start a lawnmower, right? Like you gotta pull the string, like I'm not even strong enough to pull the string, let alone see over the handlebar to actually like push it. So I'm pushing it and it looks like a schizophrenic barber like went all over the lawn. It was bad. And it took me a while to be able to actually get decent at cutting. But I did it for the whole year when I was 10, the whole summer. And then when I was 11, a friend of my mom's was like, "Hey, I need somebody to cut my yard. Do you think Alex could do it?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'll give it a try." And so for that summer, I cut my parents' yard and her yard, and I made $10 a mow at her yard, which wasn't bad. Well, word started to get out, and each year I got a little bit better, and I got a few more yards. And by the time I was 14, I was mowing between 8 and 10 yards a week. And in 1994, when you're talking about 1994 money, $80 to $100 for a 14-year-old kid, who didn't pay taxes, by the way, don't tell the government that, that's a lot of money. And what I would do is, I would take that money and I'd spend it on my friends. My friends would come over, I'd take them out, I'd be like, "Hey, let's go get some food, I'll treat you guys." All the extra money, I was a computer nerd, so I'd buy all kinds of parts for my computer, or I get pieces for my stereo. And over time, by the end of the summer when I was 14, I'd built up so much stuff in my room that I had no place to store it all. And at this time, I was getting to be a little bit compulsive about wanting things to be organized, that's the best way to put it. And so I decided, you know what I'm going to do? I need an entertainment center. Now, I'm going to bring you back to the entertainment center. This is 1990s faux wood IKEA entertainment center, if you know what I'm talking about, from the time. And so this was towards the end of the summer when I decided that I wanted this. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna save up my money for this. And every August, my father, we lived in Virginia, he would take us to the Outer Banks for our vacation. And when I was mowing, what that meant was I had to mow all my lawns like the day before I left. And then when I came back the week later, I'd have to go mow them directly again because, you know, they would have grown back in that week. So I mow the lawns that day, the day before we leave, and I get paid, obviously. And so I go upstairs to my room, and I have my dresser drawer at the top. I pull it out, and where I kept my money was inside of one of these American Express traveler's check wallets. Do you know what I'm talking about? Have you ever seen? Now, this is really dating me right here. Some of you probably don't even know what traveler's checks are, but back in the day, what would happen is if your parents were sending you on a trip and they didn't trust you with actual money, they would give you traveler's checks, and they would give you this envelope that you'd put it in. And so when you got finished, I would go on all these swimming trips, so I'd take this with me, and you'd have the envelopes. This is where I put my money, was in this American Express traveler's check envelope. So I put it in there, we go to the beach. On our way back home from the beach, the store where I'm buying this entertainment center from is having a Labor Day sale, 25% off. Uh-oh, I can buy it now, I don't have to wait. So I get home, I run upstairs to my dresser, I pull it out, and it's gone. Nowhere to be found. Now, keep in mind, we've been gone the whole week, nobody's been in our house, nobody's been around, like, it's just gone. And it's not like some criminal would come into our house and be like, okay, there's all this valuable stuff everywhere. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go up to Alex's room and take $80 from him and leave everything else. That wasn't going to happen, right? So I asked my mom and dad, I'm like, did you take it? Sometimes they would, if I had extra cash, they would take it and use it and pay me back later. They didn't take it. I can see somebody laughing. Yes, that's what we do as parents, right? We take our kids' money. So my parents would do this sometimes. They didn't take it. I asked my sisters. They didn't take it. And eventually I had to resign myself to the fact that I wasn't going to find this money. I was just going to have to earn it back. So I get back out. I mow. And eventually come September, I bought the entertainment center. And all was well because all of my stuff was organized. And I forgot about this incident. I forgot that it happened. Until a few months later, it's November, right after Thanksgiving. And I don't know about your families, but in my family, the day after Thanksgiving is the day that you put up the tree and you decorate the house. It's immediate right thereafter that you did it. So I would always help my dad get all the stuff out of the basement and bring it upstairs. And he had all these shelves and these big heavy boxes, so I'd lug them out. And my dad's putting the stuff up on the tree and I'm opening up these boxes. And at the bottom of the box is our stockings. And so I start pulling out the stockings and my stocking has a little weight to it. And I think to myself, oh my goodness, I must have left some of my candy in there from last year. And so I reach inside, and I feel, and it's not my candy. I pull it out, and it's that American Express envelope with the money inside of it. And I turned to my dad, and I was like, oh my gosh, you found my money. Why did you go through all the trouble of putting it in the box, all the way in the basement, inside of my stocking? And my dad's looking at me befuddled, and to be honest with you, my dad looked at me befuddled most of my life, so it's not unusual, but he's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, don't you remember over the summer I lost my money? And he's like, yeah, I kind of remember that. I'm like, yeah, did you put it in the stocking? He's like, no, I didn't do that. It was probably your mother. Go talk to her. Get out of my way. So I go to my mom, and I say, hey, thank you for finding my money. Why did you put it in my stocking? She doesn't remember I even lost the money. She has no recollection of that whatsoever. And she gets angry at me for even asking her. And she's like, it was probably your sisters. Can you just leave me alone? And so I go and I ask my sisters. They don't know. Now, I called my sisters up as I was writing this story, knowing I was going to tell this today, because I wanted to set the record straight, because I didn't know if they had actually done it. But you have to realize, my sisters were 6 and 9 years younger than me. So I'm 14 at the time. 9 years younger with the littlest one, she didn't do it. So it's going to be my middle sister if it's anyone. And she admitted to me, she's like, well, I did rifle through your stuff quite a bit when I was a kid. I'd go through your drawers and everything. But she goes, that feels a little bit complicated for me. Because, you know, she'd have to take it out. She didn't even know where our Christmas stuff was, and it was heavy. So I don't think she could move it. So she's like, it wasn't me. I didn't do it. So to this day, I still don't know how that American Express wallet with that money in it, how it got in to my Christmas stocking. And I will tell you that when I was 14, It reintroduced to me some of the magic of Christmas that I had lost. I'd become a jaded teenager. I don't know if you guys know what that's like, but I was a jaded teenager at that time, and I'd lost that magic, but that reintroduced it to me. And what I want to do tonight is I want to reintroduce to you some of the magic of Christmas. I want you to walk away from here tonight feeling some of that magic. Now, we've been doing a sermon series for the last couple of weeks. It's called Christmas Tableaus. And I'm sure since you all use Tableau in everyday life, you know exactly what I'm talking about, right? But for those of you who don't, let me explain what a Tableau is. So a Tableau is basically an illustration with religious overtones to it. If you've ever seen a real Tableau, it's when you take a famous painting or a picture and it's recreated in real life. So real people are recreating that picture or that painting. And then the objects in the background are made of real objects. And as I looked at the stories of Jesus' birth, I realized that all of them hinged on an object. And that if you pulled that object out from the story, that story wouldn't work any longer. So each week, we've been looking at different objects in Jesus' story. So the first week we started with Zechariah's tablet. I actually got a replica tablet from Roman times so they could see what it was like to write on a wax tablet. Second week, we had sheep where you all are sitting right now. We had literal, actual live sheep right here. It was the coolest Sunday. You talk about magical, and nobody believed I was actually going to bring them in here. They were so cool, and they didn't make a sound the entire time. They were like, they would peek out right at the time I needed them to. It's like I paid them off to do it. It was great. And then we had a Sunday where we did the star. You can see that Moravian star, so we talked about that. And then last week, we did the treasure chest with the gold, frankincense, and myrrh, and I burned frankincense so that everybody with allergies would hate me. And that was what we did for the last 4 weeks. And today, we come to the culmination of it all, the most important object in all of Jesus' stories, what it is, the manger. So I want to take a little time and talk about the manger. So the manger, why is this the most iconic of all the objects that is in Jesus' story? Well, if you see a nativity scene, what's in that nativity scene? It's literally the focal point of it, is it not? And it's the culmination of Jesus' story. Now, generally speaking, is this how you envision the manger? A nice, sanitary, wooden box specifically designed for an infant. That's what you think of, right? Because that's how they all are when you see them. But in reality, the manger that Jesus would have been in would not have been sanitary, nor would it have been especially designed for an infant. So what is a manger? A manger is literally a feeding trough for animals. You would put food and fodder inside of it. If we could travel back in time to first century Palestine, this is what the houses would look like. So what you see is every night they would bring their animals into a stable, which is literally inside of the house. It was on ground floor. They bring them in there. And the idea is that that's their most valuable assets. They didn't want those to get stolen. So they bring them inside. And in the winter, they would actually warm the house up for them. And so they bring them in. And then the rest of the house was a little bit elevated. And the way it worked was, of course, animals don't operate on the same time that we do. They don't sleep necessarily when we sleep. So what would happen is they'd get up in the middle of the night, they get hungry, and there was a wall there. The wall was not a full wall. It was only about waist high. And the animals, they could put their heads over the wall, and they could chew on food in the middle of the night when they got hungry. So even though this is how we imagine the manger, in reality, the manger that Jesus would have slept in would have been very, very unsanitary. Because you have all these animals, they're leaning their heads in, they're salivating inside of it, and they had no concept of germ theory, so it's not like they were cleaning these things out all the time. Now, I'm sure that Mary and Joseph, they threw a little hay in there for good measure to make sure he wasn't at the bottom of the trough. But just understand that Jesus' first night of sleep in this world was defined by filth and squalor, which is quite the contrast to the way our babies are raised these days. Have you ever seen these luxury baby cribs that you can get that literally monitors your child's heart rate and breathing rate at night? I remember when I was putting together for my son Elijah. He was about to be born. We had a whole baby room. We painted the thing. We made it all beautiful. It was great. Books, the whole deal, right? But Jesus, he had none of that. He wasn't born into anything like that. And do you know what he did? He grew up to become the leader of the largest religion in the history of the world. And he had none of those things. And so this manger, what it really points to is Jesus' humble origins. I think everybody knows that, right? Him being born in a manger, humble origins. Here's a king. This man is supposed to be a king. And he comes from this commoner family. But that is not the only thing that the manger represents. Yes, it represents his humble origins, but there is something much deeper going on. What this represents is what I refer to as the paradox of human life. What is the paradox of human life? Well, on the one hand, human life is incredibly versatile, resilient, and enduring, even in the most difficult of circumstances. And we see this in Jesus' story. So in Jesus' story, what happens? Mary, she gets pregnant out of wedlock. Not a good situation in the ancient world. Then they can't find a place for her to even give birth. And then you have Herod, who's hunting after Jesus to kill him because he's afraid of other kings coming into his place. And Jesus, what does he do? He prevails in all of those situations. Now, that's one side. On the other hand, what you have with human life is the fact that we are incredibly vulnerable. Human life is incredibly fragile. Have you ever held a newborn baby in your hand before? A newborn baby is so incredibly fragile. And when you have that baby in your hand, you realize they're going to need you 24/7 for the next however many years until they're able to do it on their own. And so there's this tension that exists within us. And this is a tension that you all have to deal with as well. You forget about it as you get older, but the tension is still there. We are incredibly resilient, but yet at the same time, we are extraordinarily fragile. And we can be broken very, very easily. And so when I see Jesus lying in the manger, what I am reminded of is that paradox. And what it reminds me of even more, though, is that God's love will overcome in the midst of a very dark, cruel, and unyielding world, even when it seems like there's no hope of that happening. And so tonight, what I was trying to think of when I was like, you know, if we're going to talk about the magic of Christmas, to me, the magic of Christmas is found in the tension of that paradox. That's where that magic is, between the resiliency and the frailty of human life. And if you can feel that tonight, then you will understand what Mary felt when she was giving birth to Jesus 2,000 years ago. So that's what I want to walk. I want to help you feel that tonight. And I was thinking, how can I do that? How can I make it so that you actually feel those things? And I realized that I want to tell you all a story, or more, show you a story. And this story is about a group of men known as the White Helmets. So back in 2011, you may remember, the Syrian Civil War got underway. This is when Bashar al-Assad, he started attacking his own people when they were protesting, and rather than listen to their demands, he decided, you know what? I'm just going to fight them. And this resulted in a bloody civil war. And in 2013, a group of volunteer men got together, and they started helping people in the rebel-held areas who were getting bombed. They were doing search and rescue. Basically, they were rescuing people who were in areas, mostly civilians, who had been attacked. They were doing medical evacuation. They were doing essential service delivery. These men, they were risking their lives in one of the darkest places in the world to help people who were being targeted by al-Assad's regime. By the way, just so we're clear on this, do you know why Bashar al-Assad was so successful? It's because he was aided by Vladimir Putin. And Vladimir Putin today, as we know, is the same man who is attacking Ukraine. So he's been waging war since 2011, one way or another, all around the world. And the lives that would have been lost would have been far worse had it not been for these men who put their lives out there. And so what I want to show you is a clip from a documentary called The White Helmets. It actually won the Academy Award. And you're going to see what these men do in their day-to-day lives. And you're going to understand how they hold in their hands that very paradox that I spoke about. The resilience and the fragility of life. Let's watch. Every time I see that story, oh, it just hits me right there. It's a beautiful story. And it's amazing to see that this child survived almost impossible odds. And it makes me think of Jesus in the same place. And that is the magic right there. What you just saw, that's the magic. The fragility and the resilience of life all together in one place. And that's where you see God's love manifest. Did you see it on their faces? When they were taking baby Mahmood, when they were lavishing kisses on him? And I think it's so fascinating because when you look at that, when you see that, that's one life that they save. But these men are responsible for saving more than 125,000 people in the time that they've been working in Syria. 200 of those men have lost their lives in the pursuit of helping others. And yet they persist in an area of the world that we would see as being full of total darkness. They still have hope. And I love Abu Omar's quote. It's one of my favorite quotes. I hold on to it all the time whenever I feel hopeless. He says, "Without hope, what good is life? People will die without hope." And that is so incredibly true. If you look at those men, and did you see what they were saying? These men really do believe in God in a way that I think many people don't. And that is where their hope comes from. And as a result, these men have been a light to the people of Syria in ways that nobody could have expected. And without them, I think many people would not have families. They would have lost loved ones without them being there. And so this causes me to pose a question to you all, a very important question, which is the reason why we're here tonight. Where does your hope reside? Where does your hope come from? For many people, their hope comes from their families. Maybe it comes from their friends. Maybe it comes from their pursuits, the things that they love to do. Maybe it comes from their bank account. I think for many Christians, our hope is found in that little baby Jesus lying in a manger on Christmas Eve. And the reason why that hope is there is because no matter how dark the world may seem, full of war and abuse and poverty, what that represents to us is that God's love will prevail. That no matter how stacked the odds are against us, and they can be stacked, and no matter how much we feel the weight of the world on our shoulders, do you feel that weight sometimes? Do you feel that weight on your shoulders? I know I do every day. When I feel that weight, I think about him. And what it does for me is it brings me to a point to realize that God sees that. God loves me. God wants the best for me. Because if God can take this little baby boy, Jesus, a kid who was born into the humblest of circumstances, and raise him up to become one of the most amazing figures in the history of humanity. My goodness, what can God do for you and for me? And so as you leave here this evening, as you go to celebrate Christmas with your family and your friends, I hope that you can hold on to some of that magic and mystery that Christmas is all about. Even if you lost that long ago, and I know some of you have, I know some of you lost touch with it a long time ago, I hope you can get it back. And there's all kinds of places where you can find it. Maybe tomorrow you'll see a little child opening presents and you get to see the wonder of Christmas through their eyes. Maybe tomorrow evening at dinner you'll be sitting around having a conversation with someone and it's a really unexpected conversation, something that you weren't expecting. And maybe you'll get up tomorrow morning, you'll reach inside of your stocking and you'll find a wallet that you lost a couple months earlier. You never know what you might find that's going to bring that mystery and magic back. But what I hope for you is that magic and mystery will be a part of that celebration tomorrow. Don't let go of that, because it's in that magic and mystery that we find that paradox of human life. The resilience, the fragility, but the hope that God can bring it all together. Merry Christmas to you all, and thank you for being here with me this evening. Amen.
Thanks for listening. And if you want to learn more about First Presbyterian Church of Arlington Heights, please visit www.firstpresah.org for more information on service times, directions, and to learn more about the First Pres family of faith.